The call is now live.
Great. Well, I'd like to welcome everyone. This is Caroline Fredrickson. I'm the director of the Washington Legislative Office of the ACLU. I'm here with Mike German, who's our policy counsel on national security matters, and also available is Jamil Jaffer, who's one of our attorneys in our legal department. And before we get into the meat of what we're here to talk about today, the Inspector General's report, I did want to mention that this call is being recorded and would also like to point you to other background information, which you can find at www.aclu.org/NSL. And there you'll find a variety of analytical documents about the IG report and other information about national security letters, including information about the lawsuits that Jamil has been involved with. Our press line, should you have follow-up calls after this call, is 202-675-2312. And let me just start with saying that one of the reasons we wanted to bring this call together was, for one thing, we've done some digging into the issues raised in the Inspector General's report, which we don't think were covered as thoroughly as I think is possible. And also that the executive summary that was provided really does not get into the heart of some of the most significant violations of civil liberties and some of the biggest abuses of the Patriot Act powers. And Mike German, who's here with me, has done an analysis. And so in order to prepare you for coverage of the Inspector General hearing, we thought it would be an opportunity for you to hear from Mike and ask questions about some of the issues that really haven't been explored yet about the Inspector General's report or that haven't necessarily been framed in such a way as to put the violations in the appropriate context. So let me start by introducing Mike. Mike has joined the ACLU fairly recently. After a long career in federal law enforcement, he worked as a special agent with the FBI, specializing in domestic terrorism and covert operations. As an undercover agent, Mike twice infiltrated violent neo-Nazi groups using constitutionally sound law enforcement techniques, because, yes, they do exist and should be practiced. Mike's involvement in these operations helped to successfully prevent terrorist attacks by winning criminal convictions against terrorists. And again, this is an important point because I think, as Mike will discuss, criminal convictions have been woefully absent in the use of the Patriot Act powers, which does call into question the FBI's insistence that they are necessary. And Mike's final assignment with the FBI was as a counterterrorism instructor at the FBI National Academy. As you can see, Mike has a wealth of knowledge and experience about these issues and has spent time with the Inspector General's report and in framing it against the history that we know about the Patriot Act and what he knows about the way things operate internally. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Mike.
Hi. Basically, the main things that I wanted to point out in the report somewhat conflict with what the FBI has been saying since it was published, namely that the report doesn't show any intentional misconduct. And I think when you look into the details of the report, you find that, in fact, what the Inspector General documented shows a pattern of intentional misconduct, and that this goes far beyond simple mismanagement and incompetence issues, which are bad enough in and of themselves, but actually shows that there was some intent to violate the law in these cases. And the reason that's important is because, as the IG report says, all of the information is retained and retrievable indefinitely. So whatever means the FBI is using to gather this data and whether the data itself is actually relevant to any investigations is irrelevant to the fact that it goes into these computers, these three FBI databases, and stays there forever. In turning to the improper and illegal use of the national security letters, first there was the issue with the exigent letters, which the national security law branch, well, first of all, the Office of General Counsel procurement attorneys were actually involved in creating and issuing contracts with these three telephone companies. So the idea that you could enter into an illegal contract without doing that intentionally seems a little odd, but it also shows that the OGC's office was involved in this process from the beginning and certainly knew that this was being done. Second, that National Security Law Branch attorneys were advised of this, and even though they found that it was inappropriate, they didn't stop the practice, but instead tried to work for 2 years to create a more appropriate process. But again, the fact that it was illegal should have been enough to end the program. And finally, that with the issue of certificate letters being issued to the Federal Reserve Bank, that's something that hasn't been talked about much at all, but basically the FBI used the same sorts of letters that weren't quite national security letters, weren't signed by people who were authorized to sign national security letters, and went out demanding documents from the Federal Reserve Bank, and they received those documents without the proper process. And again, that was something that that FBI officials were aware of, and even the IG doesn't come out and say that that's a process that should stop. And it brings up one important thing to keep in mind with reading through this that the IG points out in both of those circumstances, and that's that these personal relationships that are developed between the FBI agents demanding these records and the private companies that are involved. And that in both of those cases, they were able to get things circumventing the law and the legal process because of these personal relationships. And that's something that's very dangerous to the rule of law and dangerous to our democracy. It's certainly dangerous to civil rights and privacy. And the final thing I'd want to bring up is the usefulness of these national security letters. Because although the Attorney General repeats some anecdotal sort of examples of how these national security letters are important to the FBI's counterterrorism mission, in fact, he only documents very few criminal prosecutions coming out of the use of these letters, and documents only one terrorism-related prosecution for material support of terrorism that resulted in a conviction. So without any sort of demonstrable evidence that these 140-plus thousand national security request demands are being made, I think there are some more questions that need to be asked.
Well, this is Caroline. I'll turn it over to those on the phone for questions in 1 minute, but I did want to say that the Inspector General hearings are only the beginning of this process. I think several members of Congress, including Senator Spector, have recognized that the problem here is not solely, as Mike said, incompetence. This administration has clearly bumbled, but what the essential problem here is a reflection that the Patriot Act itself is highly flawed and needs to be altered. It clearly is going to be altered in the appointments process for U.S. attorneys, but much more important for the protection of the civil liberties of all Americans and upholding our Constitution is that the Patriot Act provisions concerning national security letters, Section 215, and other parts of the Patriot Act really need to be fixed. These are where the significant constitutional violations come into play. And the Patriot Act changes to the national security letter provisions allowed this whole situation to occur because it took away the limited amount of oversight that had already been in place for the issuance of national security letters by the FBI. So Congress needs to take a very close look at the Patriot Act as it moves forward. It needs to get to the bottom of this. Glenn Fine, when he testifies, will be asked any number of questions about these issues. And as Mike said, Glenn Fine does not testify that did not say in his report that the national security letters were important investigatory tools. He simply reports that FBI is saying that, and of course, why wouldn't they? They want to protect something that they know is now in danger of being lost because they showed that they had a power that they could not refrain from using improperly. when Congress does take this up, there are a couple of things. I mean, we do have a list of questions on our website, but I wanted to highlight one in particular that Congress needs to ask the administration about the National Security Letter of Use. And that is, I call the Kevin Bacon aspect of national security letters. As the IG put it, they were using national security letters to conduct fishing expeditions or, quote, to access NSL information about parties two or three steps removed from their subjects without determining if these contacts reveal suspicious connections. Well, Kevin Bacon may be a fine actor, but he shouldn't determine how we do our law enforcement, and we need a closer connection between the suspects of an investigation, the subjects of an investigation, and some illegal activity or some suspected terrorist activity. And the idea that the FBI can go on these fishing expeditions after any of our personal information is really abhorrent to the idea of checks and balances and rule of law. And now I'll turn it over to those on the call for questions. I did want to mention again that we also have Jamil Jaffer on the line, who's the Deputy Director of the ACLU National Security Program in our legal department. He's worked on NSL cases, so if anyone has a question about the cases that the ACLU has brought, which have determined that the NSL powers are unconstitutional, he is also available. Now we'll take questions.
At this time, if you have a question, please press the number one on your touch-tone phone. Please be sure to press the number one, only once. If you press it more than once, it will remove you from the question queue. Questions will be answered in the order in which they are received. And just one moment while I get your first question. Okay, Rebecca Carr, your line is open.
Hi, Mike. This is Rebecca Carr with Cox Newspapers, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more about the national security lawyers that you said were aware of the violations and that they didn't do enough to stop the program. Could you elaborate a little bit more about what you think that they were aware of and what in particular they could have done to stop the program?
Sure. It doesn't really say exactly how they became aware in late 2004 that this unit at FBI headquarters, the Communications Analysis Unit, was issuing these exigent letters. But if you read between the lines in the report, one of the things that this unit was doing was after they would receive the documents from the inappropriately through these exigent letters, they would send what's called a lead out to the field asking them to open investigations from which national security letters could be issued, and that they were getting some resistance, rightfully so, and it, I think, speaks to the agents in the field trying to do the right thing. They got resistance from the agents in the field, and they actually complained to the National Security Law Branch. So at some point in late 2004, the National Security Law Branch attorneys knew that not only that these illegal letters were being used to circumvent the National Security Letter Statute, but also that they were trying to get agents to open cases after they had received the documents. So that obviously was illegal. And the agents didn't feel it was appropriate to open these investigations. So, you know, you kind of have some very big problems that should have alerted somebody that this needed to be stopped.
It does seem as if the lawyers thought that their job was not to keep the FBI in compliance with the law, but to help the FBI cover its tracks when it had violated the law.
You know, and it wasn't just the National Security Law Branch attorneys. I mean, one of the things the IG report talks about is the lawyers in the field, what's called the Chief Division Counsel, and that they also had a problem with the way the NSL authorities were being used, but felt intimidated by their superiors and talked about how they couldn't exercise their legal judgment appropriately because they were intimidated into going along with whatever their supervisors wanted them to do.
Can I have a follow-up question on
that? Sure.
I mean, it's no secret that this week Alberto Gonzalez is clearly in the fight for his political life. I'm wondering, you know, how much of the national security letter controversy rests with his fault, and how much of it is Bob Mueller's fault? And maybe, Caroline, you're the best person to ask that. I mean, the politics behind this, who is really to blame for for yet another abuse of power?
Well, Rebecca, that's a very good question. I think ultimately, although Alberto Gonzalez can certainly be awarded the most slippery character in government right now award, he has managed to sort of to slip out of any accountability for any of the messes that have happened under his watch. But ultimately, he is the man in charge of the Justice Department, and there are too many examples of misuse, abuse, inappropriate determinations from inside the Justice Department, from the actions of the Voting Rights Division in overruling their experts on the Texas redistricting case, to the lack of prosecution of certain civil liberties violations or certain civil rights violations. And there is a whole litany here that I think, you know, perhaps Bob Mueller needs to get a little egg on his face as well, but I think ultimately Alberto Gonzalez, he's been called on the carpet by Congress, and this is just yet another item in their long list of things to talk to him about.
Okay, next we have Chitra Raghavan from U.S. News. Your line is open.
Mike, hi, Caroline.
Hello.
Hi.
So did the FBI misuse NSLs, or did they break the law? I mean, what is the legality of this?
Well, clearly they did both. You know, one of the interesting things, there's a process for internal reporting when there's a legal violation, and that's called the President's Intelligence Oversight Board. And, you know, one of the interesting things in the report is he talks about 22 of these, 19 were actually reported by the FBI. So the FBI knew of 19 violations of law. The IG looked at only a portion, 293 NSLs from 77 cases, a small portion of the 140,000 requests that were made, and he doubled the number of IOB violations. He found 60% of the files were deficient in the NSL paperwork. So that sort of stuff is just completely unacceptable in and of itself. But the exigent letters and the certificate letters show an intentional misconduct. And, I mean, these people actually got legal advice and either chose to ignore it or even with the cooperation of the attorneys, did ignore it. You know, there was some discussion of issuing these national security letters where there were no authorized investigations. And in one of those cases, I think there were six NSLs that were actually signed by a national security law branch attorney. So, I mean, Congress made these a very, very low bar to jump over to get one of these letters. All they had to do is have an investigation open and certify that that the documents they wanted were relevant to that investigation. Yet rather than do what they needed to do to meet that low standard, they actually created a shortcut around that process, and that's totally illegal. And the way they went about it was to write letters that contained knowingly false statements. And I know when I was in the FBI, FBI agents were not allowed to make false statements in official documents.
Mike, what does it say about the culture of the FBI that they would do that? And also, what happens when the FBI breaks the law? What is the recourse?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, I guess we'll have to see what the recourse is. And I hope Congress takes a very aggressive stance in demanding that there's accountability for these things. I mean, this is not just accidents. This is not just mismanagement. It's intentional misconduct. You know, with the certificate letters, a national security law branch attorney told them to stop, and they continued to send letters out. You know, it's interesting about the exigent letters. If you read the letter from Mueller to the IG in the appendix of the report, he doesn't say that the exigent letters are per se illegal. He agrees that he'll ban them, but he says that he still thinks it's okay to issue these. You know, this is totally not allowed, not appropriate by the statute. It doesn't fulfill the statute.
I do want to say one thing before turning to the next question, though, which is that ultimately, as many mistakes or violations as were committed by the FBI, this was inevitable. The Patriot Act itself set this in motion. Anytime when you give law enforcement unfettered power to pursue a case, I'm sure they were well-intentioned, but the fact of the matter is that we have checks and balances for these very circumstances. There is a reason why we have the Fourth Amendment. There is a reason why we have the other protections in our Constitution, because we want to balance zealous law enforcement with a respect for people's privacy and a respect for rule of law. And that is what the Patriot Act itself violates. We can take another question.
Our next question comes from Carol Eisenberg from Newsday. Your line is open.
Hi. You mentioned at the start that you have several lawsuits. Are there lawsuits from people who discovered they were the targets of these investigations?
Well, I'll turn that over to Jamil to answer.
Yes, we have two lawsuits that we filed against national security letters. One of them is ongoing. The one that's not ongoing was filed on behalf of a consortium of librarians that received a national security letter. That consortium, with our help, challenged the constitutionality of a gag order imposed on them that prevented them from disclosing even the mere fact that they had been served with a national security letter. And the judge in that case agreed with us that the gag order was unconstitutional. The clients, the librarians, can now speak openly about their experiences. The other lawsuit is one that's ongoing. Our client in that case is an internet service provider that was served with the national security letter several years ago. That lawsuit is ongoing because we've challenged not only the gag order issued on that particular ISP, but we have challenged the constitutionality of the NSL statute itself. And we're challenging the statute insofar as it allows the FBI unilaterally to impose gag orders on individuals or entities served with national security letters. Our complaint is essentially that the FBI should not have the unchecked authority to issue these gag orders in every single case, but rather that the FBI, to the extent that secrecy is necessary, the FBI should have to go to a court, prove to a court secrecy is actually necessary in the specific case, and the judicial oversight would both satisfy the First and Fourth Amendment, the First Amendment, and would also serve as a kind of check against the sort of abuses that are outlined in the IG's report. Because we do think that, but for these gag provisions, but for these gag orders issued on NSL recipients, the kind of abuse that the IG discusses in the report might have been exposed much, much earlier, and some of it might have been averted.
But have you been contacted by anyone else since the IG's report was released?
I would just point out that there's a gag order in the statute that generally prevents anyone served with a national security letter from disclosing even the fact that that person has been served with an NSL. So it's difficult for me to answer that question in a way that would be useful to you.
I would say, just on a general note, though, that I've had many, many people coming to me to ask how to request information about whether or not their files have been scooped up in one of these national security letters. So I think there may or may not be additional ongoing cases, but there certainly is a greater awareness among the American public that their personal information has been subject to inappropriate requests by the FBI.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and before we go to our next question, I'd just like to say, if you have a question or comment, please press the number one on your touch-tone phone. And our next question comes from Luke O'Brien with Wired News. Your line is open.
If you can talk a little bit more about the relationship that you describe between FBI investigators and phone companies. It sounds, as you put it, kind of overly cozy, and I'm just wondering, in your experience, what that looks like, how that works, and what kind of burden of proof the FBI has when they come asking for these records. Are phone companies just rolling over, or is anyone standing up to them?
It's a good question. I think it needs to be asked, and Congress needs to get the answers to it. You know, part of the problem, you know, when I first heard of this exigent letter issue and the fact that, that there wasn't evidence that they were following up with the proper process, before I saw the report, I wondered why the phone companies would accept that. I mean, after all, it's their liability that's at risk by giving up the records without the proper process. But then when I saw the report and realized that there were actually contracts for them to do this, you know, it raises the possibility that because there's a money trail, that they have some other incentives and that, you know, they could be providing this information to the government simply because it's lucrative for them. Who knows? But, you know, the personal relationships are dangerous because, you know, if you're a private citizen out there and an FBI agent comes to you and says, you know, we have a terrorism investigation and I really need your help, it's very easy to think that you're doing the right thing by giving up the records when, in fact, that's why Congress passes these laws, so that everybody knows what information should be protected and how it should be protected and how the government should go about getting the information that it needs.
And I think there are other examples of cozy relationships, and maybe Mike could speak a little bit about the certificate letters, but I think the relationships between the FBI and the Federal Reserve Bank are also very concerning.
Right, and in that case, there were, I think, 244 named individuals whose private financial records were gathered by the FBI with these certificate letters, and while apparently, according to the report, the Federal Reserve Bank said that they did not think that that was a problem. What they said was, it depends on who the FBI asks at the Federal Reserve Bank on what documents they would get for these letters, which kind of shows that the cozy relationships are a problem. But one of the things they did confirm is the Federal Reserve Bank's policy is to receive the proper process. So the fact that they were violating their own policy should be an indicator that what they were doing was improper.
Okay. One other quick question. I'm wondering about the databases, these national security letter databases that have been set up. Do other agencies have access to those that you know of or not?
Yes, apparently they do. According to the report, again, there are non-FBI users that have access to these databases, and that would include people from other agencies that are on the Joint Terrorism Task Force and possibly others in the intelligence community. So that's really the problem, is if the FBI uses an improper process or an overly broad national security letter to gather somebody's information inappropriately, as the IG said, a lot of times the analysts and the agents don't even look at the documents that they get in return for these national security letters. So a telephone company or a financial institution might have turned over something accidentally that was of the wrong person, but that data still gets uploaded into these huge databases. And the intelligence products that the FBI puts out are based on the data that's in. And there's the old saying, the garbage in, garbage out. You know, if you're getting a lot of irrelevant and innocent information into these databases, you're polluting what you have, and you're inappropriately linking people who are completely innocent to terrorism investigations. And that's, you know, a huge violation of civil liberties.
Okay, thanks.
Our next question comes from D.H. Kirby with Freelance. Your line is open.
Yes, hello, I'm Mr. German. I was wondering if you could say a few words about the consequences of ignoring or refusing to comply with an NSL. What could that mean in an individual's life?
That could mean going to jail. There are criminal penalties associated with what you would do or refuse to complying with NSLs or speaking out about the gag. So, you know, this is something that can be very destructive. You can imagine working in a company and getting an extraordinarily broad national security letter that you know is inappropriate, and yet there's nothing you can do because you can't say anything to anybody.
And I also think Jamil could probably speak to how this plays out in the actual cases that we're litigating.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two different things going on here. First, there are penalties for ignoring an NSL. What happens in practice is that if you ignore an NSL, the government, the FBI, can go to court, get a contempt order. If you ignore the contempt order, then, you know, as Mike says, you can be incarcerated, or you can be convicted of a criminal penalty of a criminal offense for having done that. The other thing that happens, and our clients have been facing this for the last few years, and especially since the reauthorization of the Patriot Act, which specified criminal penalties for violating the gag. What happens is people get these national security letters. They want to consult others about the national security letters. Until Congress reauthorized the Patriot Act, people were under the impression that they couldn't even consult attorneys. One good thing that was done by the reauthorization bill is it made clear that people could, recipients of NSLs, could consult attorneys. Unfortunately, I think that's perhaps the only good thing that the Reauthorization Act did with respect to the gag provisions. Otherwise, the gag provisions have been made even more oppressive than they were before. And the gag provisions, again, the secrecy that surrounds the FBI's use of national security letters is clearly one of the factors that is leading to the kinds of abuses that the IG discussed in his report. Without that kind of secrecy, the FBI would be subject to at least some degree of public scrutiny, public accountability, and there would be at least some kind of check against abuse. When you have this kind of blanket secrecy that surrounds the use of this kind of intrusive surveillance power, you're just inviting abuse. And that, you know, that's part of the reason why we continue to challenge the appropriateness and not to mention the constitutionality of the gag provisions.
Thanks very much.
You know, let me just follow up as well. The IG report does talk about one NSL that was inappropriately broad, issued on a North Carolina university. That was asking for things that aren't authorized under the NSL statutes. And if you look at the companion report that the IG put out on the FBI's use of its Patriot Act Section 215 powers, he talks about one occasion where they're attempting to use the 215 power, but they weren't getting it quick enough. So he says in the end, that they just issued an NSL for the information. And you wonder if the NSL also wasn't overly broad. I mean, obviously the agents felt they needed to apply for a 215 order. And, you know, a lot of times these records are being held by third parties who don't really have an interest in whether or not they give more than is required under the law. So, you know, perhaps there are other NSL letters like this that go out asking for more than they're authorized to get with an NSL. And they end up getting records that they're not entitled to.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Sandra Torrey with U.S. Today. Your line is open.
Hi, it's USA Today. Just a couple of things. You mentioned in the Patriot reauthorization that the one good thing was letting people know that they can get attorneys, consult attorneys, but that otherwise the gag provisions were more oppressive. Can you give me more detail on how they're more oppressive?
Sure. Caroline, should I take that one?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. So the way the gag provisions work now, the FBI decides on a case-by-case basis whether to impose a non-disclosure order on the recipient of the NSL. As far as I know, the FBI has imposed non-disclosure orders in every single case. What happens because of those non-disclosure orders is that most people who receive NSLs don't discuss that fact with anyone. With lawyers, some of them, I'm sure, now, especially since the Reauthorization Act, do discuss it with lawyers. But other than lawyers, they don't speak about it with anyone. The very few there are only two, as far as I know, the very few NSL recipients who actually challenge NSL demands in court or challenge the gag orders in court. The way those challenges work now is that the FBI certifies that secrecy is necessary. The court is required to defer to the FBI certification that secrecy is necessary. And the court essentially acts as a rubber stamp on the FBI's determination that secrecy is necessary. So there is judicial review of a kind. It's a kind of cosmetic judicial review. But what's really happening is that the court is being asked to rubber stamp the FBI's decision. We don't think that satisfies First Amendment requirements. Ordinarily, in this context, courts uphold gag orders only if the government has a compelling interest in the gag order, and only if the gag order is narrowly tailored to the government's compelling interest. That's the First Amendment standard. Rather than impose that standard on the FBI, the NSL statute says that the court should defer to the FBI's certification that secrecy is necessary. That's the reason why we continue to challenge the constitutionality of the NSL statute, and that's the main center of the case that we have now briefed before the Southern District of New York, and that's going to be argued in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
And the two cases you know about are the two cases that you've been involved in, basically?
That's right. I don't know of any other challenges to the National Security Letter Authority. There are certainly no other public challenges to the National Security Letter Authority. Given the kind of secrecy that surrounds the use of national security letters, it's conceivable that there are some challenges that are still under seal,
mm-hmm.
But obviously I don't know about those.
Okay, and again, these go to third parties holding this, so they're holding the information, so generally they wouldn't have that big an interest in challenging them.
That's right. And if you just look at the two clients that we have, the first national security letter was served on, as I said, a library consortium, and the second one was served on a very small internet service provider. I can't say more about the second client than that because it's still under a gag order. But suffice to say that we're not talking about AT&T and Verizon. We're talking about entities that have an unusual interest in protecting the privacy of their patrons or subscribers.
Okay. And the other thing, it seemed to me there was a contradiction in the IG report. At one point, they said what you talked about a few minutes ago, the databases and the fact that there's information in these databases and it's shared by a number of different departments and authorities. But there was another point, I thought, when they said that there was no standard or guideline to even upload this information. So is it also true that some of this, we don't even know, it's just in paper files and isn't being uploaded or kept anywhere?
I think the portion you're talking about is where the IG was talking about the instances in which the recipient of the NSL turned over more records than what were requested. And the agents in the field were calling the Office of General Counsel at the FBI to ask, what do we do with these things? You know, are we allowed to destroy them? Should we send them back? Do we keep them? What do we do? And apparently we're only getting ad hoc advice, so the agents were doing what agents would do in that situation and doing whatever they felt was appropriate, but apparently in some cases this information was being uploaded into the database, totally irrelevant to their requests even. And it was only in November of 2006, after the IG audit was in full swing, that the Office of General Counsel ever even issued a policy or issued guidance. And their guidance is simply for the agents to send the excess data to OGC for a determination, but with no policy, what would their determination be? I mean, under what justification could they possibly keep records they hadn't even asked for? It seems kind of odd that they would say at some point that they might decide to retain these records that, that had not been requested and had not been appropriately turned over to them.
And have you gotten any complaints from any person who says they think, not that they've been asked to turn over records, but they think they've been the subject of an NSL? Have you gotten, or do you know of anybody who's you know, gotten calls from, you know, a citizen or anybody who's been the subject of one of these and feels their information has been turned over?
Well, you know, I think it would be a rare occurrence because the provider of the information would be under a gag, so they would have violated already by telling the subject that they're turning over the records. But I don't
know. Well, I mean, or somebody felt for, I don't know, I could see a circumstance where somebody found out somehow, even if they weren't told, but I'm just wondering if they're...
I don't know, Jamil, if you have any experience of that.
Okay.
I don't, but, you know, I think Caroline is, I mean, Caroline is right. I mean, one of the reasons that that our two clients wanted to challenge the constitutionality of the gag orders was that they wanted to tell their patrons and subscribers that they were the subject of what they regarded as illegitimate requests. So, you know, Caroline is right that most people who are the subject, the vast majority of people who are the subject of national security letters never find out about it. I imagine that when people are actually prosecuted, the government may have to give up that little piece of information, the piece of information that that they had obtained through the national security letter. But other than that, other than in that context, I can't imagine how somebody would find out.
When a subpoena is sought for records about you in a run-of-the-mill criminal case, would you, the subject of the subpoena, know that? Would the phone company tell you that, or the financial company tell you that a subpoena had been that they've gotten a subpoena for your records?
With grand jury subpoenas, ordinarily
yeah.
There is no gag order associated with a grand jury subpoena.
And the
effect of that is that the third party record holder has the option of discussing the fact that there was a subpoena served on them and the content of the subpoena. If the FBI wants to impose a gag order in an individual case, the FBI can do so by going to a court and explaining the necessity of secrecy and having the court issue the gag order. And that's the way we think things should work in the NSL context.
But you know, if generally third parties do bother to tell people in, the garden variety criminal case, they must get these subpoenas a lot.
I can speak only anecdotally on this mm-hmm. on this point that in some context, the FBI itself or the prosecutor will tell the subject of the request or the subject of the subpoena, meaning the target of the investigation, that they are a target. I don't know, you know, I can't give you the categorical rule because I just don't know it.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Michael Sniffen with AP. Your line is open.
Mike, these contracts between the FBI and the and the telephone companies, were they the ones that provided them, the companies, with reimbursement for gathering this information for the FBI?
Well, it doesn't say in the report what the reimbursement structure was, but it says an OGC procurement attorney was involved, which indicates there's money involved. So, you know, we haven't seen the contracts yet, so we don't know what they say.
Okay.
Okay. If you do have a question or comment, please press the number 1 on your touch-tone phone one time. And our next question comes from Citra Raghavan with U.S. News. Your line is open.
Thank you. You know, I'm always confused. On the one hand, we say that the FBI's technology is so awful that, you know, they've still got these black and green screen computers and they, you know, all of that stuff. But on the other hand, we talk about these databases that they have. So are we talking, where were these records kept and how are they being shared?
The report talks about three databases that the FBI used for these records. One is the automated case support, which is
the legacy system. Right?
Which is the legacy system, right. That's the one that they tried to do away with Trilogy and imp- put Trilogy in its place, and then Trilogy fell apart, so they, I guess they fell back on automated case support. The report says that there are 29,000 FBI users and 5,000 non-FBI users. The report also mentions the telephone applications database, which is a link analysis data mining program. It's unclear whether that's something that, you know, internally within the FBI, or whether that's some private contractor that has that application. But there are 19,000 users, according to the IG report. And then finally, the investigative data warehouse, which is really the most troubling of them all. It, according to the IG report, has 560 million records from 50 different government databases. And that, according to the IG, has 12,000 users, and he indicates that JTTFs have access to that database. So, I mean, it kind of goes back to the old total information awareness days, where all this information is being thrown into these huge databases, and apparently without any sort of clear oversight on what's going in. And, you know, I think that's a huge problem for both privacy and civil liberties.
On the legacy system, who are the 5,000 non-FBI users? Who would want to use that system anyway?
You know, certainly other law enforcement and other intelligence community personnel.
I thought it was specific to the FBI. It's not?
Well, according to the IG report, it says there are 5,000 non-FBI users. That's page 28 of the report.
And then IDW, I mean, how did they come up with that system if they couldn't get the legacy system? I mean, that's something they designed themselves, and it has all of this information?
You know, and that's something that probably will be coming out, hopefully. The IG has another report that's overdue on the FBI's data mining programs. I believe that was due the same day as the 215 and the National Security Letter reports. So, you know, perhaps we'll get more information about these databases then.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Greg Piper with Washington Internet Daily. Your line is open.
Hey, folks. I just had a question here about how you initially said that the IG report really skipped over the heart of civil liberties violations. And I'm just curious here. I'm not exactly familiar with whether IG reports typically are a little cautious in their summaries, but why would it kind of soft pedal what their evidence seemed to be saying, which is that there were very intentional violations here, and not just very bad, knowledge about exact procedure?
I think my point was more the fact that the executive summary really didn't go into the significant violations that were laid out much more clearly in the full report. But there is, I think, a set of questions that Congress needs to follow up on about the intentionality. Although, again, as the report says, there doesn't seem to have been intentional acts. I really have a hard time understanding how somebody under false pretenses can use an exigent letter, knowing full well that there were no exigent circumstances, and knowing full well that exigent letters aren't actually authorized under the law. So it really begs the question of what the Inspector General's definition of intentional is. And so I think that's something that Congress will get very deep into, and maybe come to a different conclusion about whether there was an intentional misuse or not.
You know, and having been a criminal investigator, I can say that one of the things that you look for in a case like this involving sort of process issues is inculpating behavior. And if you look at the security letters segment of the IG report, you know, he talks about the National Security Law Branch attorneys getting concerned about it and talking to the people in headquarters who are using these letters and being told falsely that the letters weren't being used to obtain records, simply that they were just simply asking the Federal Reserve Bank to locate the records and say whether they had records relating to these people. So, I mean, the fact that you would be giving a false statement to your attorney indicates that they knew that what they were doing was wrong. The same with the communications analysis unit, that they would use these exigent letters number one, that contained false statements, not just in saying that there was an emergency when there wasn't, but also the letters on their face said, we have already asked for a grand jury subpoena, which wasn't true, and they knew it not to be true. But once they would receive the documents, they would then send the leads to the field asking them to open cases and issue letters without telling them that they already had the records, which, again, indicates that they knew what they were doing was inappropriate.
Okay, thanks.
Once again, at this time, if you do have a question, please press the number one on your touchtone phone now. And we do have a follow-up question from Sandra Torrey with USA Today. Your line is open.
Thank you. What you just mentioned, that the executive summary, and I'm sorry if I missed this, I wasn't on the beginning of the call, that the executive summary on some of the main points where the law you believe was being violated wasn't detailed enough. This is a fairly daunting report. Are there a few sections within the main report that you think are worth looking at for those examples of those?
Well, you know, certainly the exigent letters portion of the report and certainly the certificate letters portion of the report, which is barely mentioned, if at all, in the executive summary.
Yeah, I didn't even realize that was existed. They're called certificate letters.
Certificate letters, and that starts at page 115, which again kind of shows how it's buried in the back of the report.
Okay.
And some of the other things that are in there that are sort of brushed over. Number one, look at the communications analysis unit. I mean, again, the only requirement of these NSLs is that there is an authorized investigation and that you have an analysis unit at headquarters issuing letters they're not an investigative unit. So it would have been clear that there's no business for them to be going out doing their own investigations. But also there were some other units at headquarters who were issuing these letters, again, without any authorized investigations and actually, you know, receiving advice to open control files from which to send national security letters out, which is directly in violation of the law. So that sort of thing sort of shows, to me, intent as opposed to simple bookkeeping errors, which the IG reports talks about early in the
when
report.
You talk about opening control letters,
opening control files.
What is that about? Who should be doing that?
Control files are not investigations. Typically, they're open where some information has been received on a particular topic, and it's not enough information to open an investigation, but you simply don't know enough about it, so you have to put it somewhere, and it's placed in these control files.
Okay.
But it's certainly not an authorized investigation. You know, the Attorney General has guidelines that have to be met in order for the FBI to open an investigation, which I believe is why Congress said you have to at least have an investigation open to authorize the use of these NSLs. And I think what Congress was trying to do was to make sure that this NSL power was actually being used as an investigative tool rather than just a crude collection mechanism. And that's why they wanted it to be tied to an investigation. And, you know, what's a clear indicator that that's not how it's being used is what the IG report says, which is the agents and the analysts weren't even reviewing what they were getting back. They were simply putting it in the database. And that kind of shows that this is being used improperly. You know, he mentions 9 separate letters requested 11,000 telephone numbers, information on 11,000 telephone numbers. And that, again, just shows that it's this wholesale collection effort that's not really part of an investigation that's directed at people truly suspected of being involved in terrorism.
And I'm sorry, those 9 letters were exigent letters?
No, those were NSL, national security letters. He was talking about the number of NSL requests as compared to letters, pointing out that 140,000 plus national security letter requests were actually, there were fewer numbers of NSLs, and he pointed out that there were 9 separate NSLs that took in 11,000 records.
Okay.
or numbers.
You know, I would say if I knew anything about fishing, I'd make an analogy here. But, you know, this is clearly not fly fishing. We're talking about a fishing expedition. This is trawling or net fishing. They are scooping up vast amounts of information and not even sorting it properly. How important can it be, really, to helping us fight terrorism if they don't even bother to look at it?
Okay, and next we do have a follow-up from Luke O'Brien with Wired News.
Yeah, I was wondering, just on the heels of your last comment there, you say 140,000 of these national security letters have been issued, but they've resulted in very few successful prosecutions, and I'm just wondering, if they're not that useful, why do they keep issuing so many of them?
I think part of the problem is, and I think it shows in the fact that the Communications Analysis Unit felt like they weren't getting enough NSLs, that they had to come up with a way to gather even more data, is that you have agents who are doing collection rather than investigation. And if you are a well-intentioned, hard-charging FBI agent and your job is to collect, you're going to collect. And you're going to collect as much as you can to show how hard a worker you are. And that's really the problem with this whole approach to counterterrorism, is that it's not focused on the very few number of real terrorists there are out there. It is instead this fishing net approach that tries to get information about everybody. And this idea that somehow if we have all the data, we'll be able to know who the terrorists are is simply ludicrous. But I think a lot of it is that, you know, this idea that data mining is somehow going to be the answer, and I think, you know, the FBI and a lot of other agencies have bought into this basically snake oil, that somehow if you have all this data, the number of terrorists or the correct data on the terrorists will somehow rise to the top, I think is a false notion. But I think that there are a lot of companies out there making a lot of money selling these products to the government.
Yeah, and on that note, I mean, you've talked a lot about the phone companies, but what about ISPs? I didn't see a whole lot of that in the report.
He does not talk about ISPs, except that, that of course, the NSL authority that gives the FBI the authority to ask for information from the telephone companies can also be used against Internet service providers.
Okay. Thanks.
Once
and, of course,
again,
a lot of telephone companies are Internet service providers as well. So,
once again, at this time, if you do have a question, please press the number one on your touch-tone phone now. And at this time, I shall no additional questions.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us. This call will be posted on our website. And you can go for further information about national security letters and the IG report to www.aclu.org/NSL. You can also follow up with our communications department at 202-675-2312. We're available for any additional questions that you may have today, tomorrow, midnight, 6 a.m., whenever you'd like to call. We're there. So thank you again, and we'll look forward to tomorrow's hearing.
This officially ends today's conference. Have a good afternoon.
You too.